This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. This week, the United Kingdom's Human Fertilization and Embryology Authority, the HFEA, gave scientists the green light to edit the genes of human embryos using the technique known as CRISPR-Cas9. Even though the scientists will be destroying the embryos they experiment on, with no intention to implant the embryos, some critics have called it the first steps toward designer babies. Possible? Or as one of my next guests, Hank Greeley, has said, should we simply keep calm and CRISPR on? What do you think? Our number is 844-724-8255. Joining me to demystify the science behind this experiment, before we get into the ethical and legal conundrums, is George Daly. He's a professor at Harvard Med School and director of the Stem Cell Transplantation Program at Boston's Children's Hospital. Welcome back, Dr. Daly.
It's good to be here, Ira.
Let's talk a bit about how this process works, about what the scientist Kathy Nayak and her lab want to do.
Yeah, well, it takes advantage of this incredibly powerful new technique called CRISPR. It's essentially a bacterial immune system that's been adapted for use in human cells. You know, just like we're bombarded with viruses, bacteria have developed a way of fighting off viruses. They recognize the invader and chop it up. So scientists have been able to adapt this to human cells in a way that allows us to very specifically identify a gene, recognize it, and either chop it up, deleting its activity, or repair it, a process we call gene editing. What Dr. Nayak now wants to do is employ this very powerful method for gene editing in human embryos.
Well, can't we just study this in mice like we do other things?
Well, you know, mice aren't people. We really can't answer the critical questions about human development in mice. It turns out that mice develop differently. The principles we've discovered in mice don't seem to work in humans. So Dr. Nayakin really wants to address very critical questions in human development. And this is going to shed important light on questions like infertility, miscarriages, and birth defects.
It's something you can only do when you study it in humans.
That's right. That's right.
And the CRISPR is very well known, isn't it? It's widely used now.
You know, it's only been described about 3 years ago for its applications, and yet it's now swept the international biomedical community. I mean, virtually every laboratory is taking advantage of this. It's so powerful, so efficient, and so easy to use that it's finding all sorts of very exciting new applications.
I'd like to bring on another guest. Hank Greeley is a law professor at Stanford and director of the Center for Law and the Biosciences there. Welcome back, Hank.
Thanks for calling me.
Let's talk about the regulatory body in the UK, the HFEA. How much wiggle room is there in their authority to use this technology? And I mean, in terms of it being misused.
Well, HFEA has broad power over really all assisted reproduction in the UK. We have nothing like it in the United States. And if you do something that they haven't allowed you to do or do something against the rules they've set down, you can be punished. Just because something's illegal doesn't necessarily mean that it won't happen. But when you're regulating something like IVF clinics, these are people with licenses and businesses and something at stake to lose. So I'm not aware of anyone violating HFEA, intentionally violating HFEA procedures.
Is there a feeling worldwide that this is pretty, you know, that the doctors are going to do what they say they are doing and not trying to experiment bringing human embryos to term?
Yeah, I don't think there are a lot of mad scientists in this field. I think most mad scientists are in movies and in books.
I mean, the scientific community has really come out very strongly in favor of kind of regulation and kind of self-policing in this area. We had a global summit sponsored by the Chinese Academy of Sciences, the United States Academy, and the United Kingdom Academies. That was held in Washington in December. And our organizing committee really endorsed the need for the research that we're talking about today that's been approved in the UK, as long as it remained laboratory-based. because applying gene editing to embryos for clinical use, say for IVF or for bringing a baby to term, isn't sanctioned, and there's been really a broad call for caution and prudence in the scientific community.
Mm-hmm. And really, when you think about trying to make a baby using a previously unknown technique, the potential downside is enormous. The idea of bringing seriously disabled or deformed or dead children into the world is a serious constraint. There are legal ramifications. There are medical licensure ramifications. The woman who's a necessary part of it would have to consent to it. It doesn't mean that it's impossible, that it's some strange corner of the world. Somebody might try something inappropriate. But I think it's not very likely. Dealing with humans, making babies with humans, comes with lots of inherent constraints that, say, work with non-humans does not.
Mm-hmm. And is Great Britain the first country to okay to do this? Have the Chinese used CRISPR on human embryos?
Yes. It first occurred in China. There was, in fact, a paper that was published reporting the first experience with editing human embryos. And it was in part that paper that stimulated a strong interest in the scientific community to get out ahead of this, to establish guidelines, and to make sure that the work is being done with the proper kind of thoughtful oversight, and that it's not being moved prematurely into clinical use. So the UK, under this HFEA authority, they've really established a very high standard, and they've ensured that this project has real scientific merit, and that's why it's been approved.
The Chinese regulatory authorities were involved, as we understand it, in that original study. Their regulatory system's a little more opaque than ours, and I think one of the good things that may come out of the CRISPR summit in December is a little more discussion and transparency back and forth between different countries about their regulatory systems. One of the really nice things about the Chinese experiment is they used embryos that could not become babies, embryos that had been fertilized by two sperm, and even if you had tried to put them into a woman's womb, they could not lead to a pregnancy and a birth. The HFEA is using the HFEA research, the research that was approved by the HFEA is using normal embryos, but with the requirement that the lab not transfer them into a woman for possible birth.
Mm-hmm. Do you don't see the U.S., the FDA, okaying any kind of research like this in the near future, do you, Hank?
It's actually illegal right now, mm-hmm. in a funny sort of way. Congress decided to ban all funding for FDA to even consider this kind of thing. Ironically, when they first tried it, they did it in a way that would have backfired. They said FDA can spend no money to consider any such proposal. But the way FDA works when it's approving research, if you submit a research application called an investigative new drug exemption application or an IND, it goes into effect unless the FDA blocks it in 30 days. Ultimately, for this year's appropriations bill, or appropriations for NIH and FDA, Congress said not only can't they spend any money, but no such application will be deemed not to have been received. So since they never receive it, the 30-day timetable can't start. That's an appropriations rider. It lasts for 1 year. But for that year, FDA will not be able to issue any INDs allowing researchers to try this.
Mm-hmm.
To try this with respect to putting it into humans, to try this in terms of making babies. The non-clinical work, the work that George and I have been talking about and the work that the HFEA approved, doesn't go through FDA at all because it doesn't involve giving a new drug or a device to a human being.
So who would it go through?
Basically almost nobody in the United States.
So you could try it yourself?
You couldn't try it with federal funding.
Yeah.
Federal funding
right.
is not available.
There's a real distinction here. I mean, there's a distinction between what you can use your federal grant dollars to study, which is certainly not this, and what is at least permissible under private funds. And there is now underway a process that the International Society for Stem Cell Research is going to put forth. And it's a set of guidelines that really govern the conduct of human stem cell research and embryo research. It's been widely discussed. We presented it in draft form this past summer, and it'll be released probably in March or April. And like the HFEA, it's going to lay out a set of ethical standards and responsible practices so that this type of very important research can in fact be done. It'll have to be approved by a very rigorous process of institutional review and oversight, but we do hope that this work gets done in the United States. It'll have to be done with private funding, but it's essential. It's going to teach us a tremendous amount about the earliest days of human development.
What about treating diseases? Are there real some diseases are just ready for this kind of research?
Well, the research we're talking about right now is laboratory based. It will be targeted at problems, not really diseases, but conditions like miscarriage and infertility. And so it will have an effect there, and it is valuable. Now, the longer-term questions that arise is whether this technique could ever be used to eradicate disease in an embryo, that is, to prevent a baby from coming into the world with a particular disease. Could we treat it at that embryonic stage? Now, there are some who think that's a very laudable goal, but it also raises this thornier question of modifying human heredity. You know, if we intervene in an embryo and cure a disease in an embryo, that means that person's offspring
would also
carry this genetic change.
Yeah, we've run out of time. You can see the ethical problems there. Hank Greeley, law professor at Stanford, and George Daly, professor at Harvard Med School. Thank you both for taking time to be with us today.
My pleasure.
We're gonna take a break, and when we come back, science journalist Joe Marchant asks, "Can our minds help us heal?" We'll talk about her new book, Cure, and the effects of minds on our bodies. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Most of us have a sense that what goes on in our minds affects our bodies. Like you feel a little bit nauseous before a presentation, right? Then you know how fear can go straight to your gut. Or try this. Think about a drop of sour lemon juice splashing over your tongue, right? You can feel that tingle. But if you start talking about how these powerful thoughts might help us heal or ward off disease, expect some raised eyebrows. In Western medicine, the idea of healing thoughts can give off the distinct whiff of woo, conjuring religious gurus laying on hands and Reiki masters harnessing undetectable energy fields. It's sort of just a no-no to talk about this stuff. Well, brave science writer Joe Marchant is having none of your energy fields or your auras. She has her PhD in genetics and medical microbiology, after all, but she did get curious. In our rush to avoid medical quackery, have we sidelined the mind's role in medicine? Can thoughts help us heal? In her new book, Cure, A Journey into the Science of Mind Over Body, she reviews the evidence for and against mind-body medicine. Joe Marchant joins me now from London. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Were you a little bit wary about taking on this topic?
Probably not as wary as I should have been. I was just interested, and I've kind of came to realize as I continued just how divisive a topic this can be and how strong feelings can be on it.
Did your friend say you were a little bit nutty when you were working on this book?
My scientist and science journalist friends just would roll their eyes, mostly. But my friends outside of science, you know, my mom friends at the primary school, sounded really interested. They wouldn't have been interested in any of the other books that I've written, but there's something about this topic that fascinated them. So, it was kind of a reversal from what I usually get.
So what is the main takeaway from all that you've learned here?
It is that we should be taking seriously the role of the mind in health, and particularly in our medical system. I think we need to take seriously and research in an evidence-based way how we deliver care. So not just the drugs that we're prescribing, but how those drugs are delivered. It's not as simple as saying, oh, the mind can cure, obviously. But equally, it's not right to say that the mind plays no role in health. So sometimes the mind can have very dramatic immediate effects, particularly when it comes to symptoms such as pain, for example. Sometimes the mind has no effect at all. You know, a diabetic is never going to replace insulin that their body needs using the mind. Sometimes the mind can be a sort of subtle factor among many that influences our disease risk over long periods of time, a bit like diet or exercise. So I think we need to take a scientific approach to studying this and working out when and where and who does the mind help.
But you never really find many research. You talk about taking a scientific approach. Who would study this? And no one is going to spend a lot of money, right? Because it doesn't involve the product that can be sold or treatments that would, you know, make money for people.
Yeah, there are a lot of obstacles. So absolutely, money is one. You don't have a product to sell with a psychological approach like this. So who's going to fund those trials? There's also a kind of prejudice against even studying this stuff. Several of the researchers that I interviewed for the book had, you know, they felt that this had a real effect on their reputation. They'd had real misgivings before going into studying something like hypnosis or mindfulness. So you have to be pretty brave to even get into this in the first place. And then there are just issues with trial design, for example, because in medicine we test our treatments against placebo in randomized controlled trials. And that's, you know, a great thing that we do that. That's extremely important so that we can tell that the drugs and treatments that we're testing actually work. But it means that anything else about how a treatment works, any way that it might be influencing or harnessing a patient's psychological resources in terms of, you know, expectation or reducing stress or providing social support, all of those components of care kind of get cancelled out in the trial because they're present in the placebo arm as well as in the drug arm. So we don't have any way of kind of measuring or valuing these other aspects of care. So that's a big problem as well, I think.
Speaking of placebos, you point out in the book quite often that the placebo effect is real and it really does work.
Yeah, this really surprised me, actually. We tend to think of the placebo effect as kind of a bit of an illusion, I suppose. So, you know, obviously a lot of people get better anyway with time, regardless of what you give them. But what neuroscientists are finding is that there is also a kind of specific effect in some cases where just the response to receiving treatment, placebo or real, creates biochemical effects in the brain and body that are very similar to those caused by drugs. So a placebo painkiller can trigger the release of endorphins, natural pain relieving chemicals in the brain. And these are exactly the chemicals that opioid drugs, morphine and heroin, are designed to mimic. So if you take a placebo and your pain is eased, you haven't just imagined that. You haven't just changed your perception of the pain. It's actually been eased through exactly the same biochemical pathway as would have occurred if you'd taken a real painkiller. But then in Parkinson's, for example, when patients take a placebo, they get a flood of dopamine, the neurotransmitter dopamine, in their brains, exactly as they would when they take their real Parkinson's drug. Or even with altitude sickness, you can give people fake oxygen and you get a reduction in prostaglandins in the brain. And these dilate blood vessels and they cause many of the symptoms of altitude sickness. So there isn't just one placebo effect. There are many, depending on the condition, and they each need to be studied separately. But the sort of principle is that you are getting these measurable biological changes triggered in response to these placebos that are, you know, this very similar to those changes that are caused by drugs.
Yeah, there was one amazing one that you talked about. We meet Bonnie, who gets placebo back surgery. I didn't think there was such a thing. How does a doctor do placebo surgery?
Well, this is a technique called vertebroplasty, which involves injecting cement into a fractured vertebra to strengthen it. And it was a few years ago having great results, you know, becoming very popular, patients recovering dramatically, until a few trials were done comparing it against this sham surgery where the patient goes into the room and they're given an injection of local anesthetic. And only then does the surgeon open the envelope to find out whether they're getting the real injection or not. And then if they're in the placebo group, the team go through exactly the same steps. So they open the cap of cement, so the smell kind of spreads through the room. They have a script where they say all exactly the same words as they would do if they were injecting the real cement. So even though patients know they might be receiving placebo, it's kind of a very convincing theatrical mm-hmm. performance that they're in the active group. And I met Bonnie, who was in this particular trial. She'd sort of slipped on wet tiles and fractured her spine, and she loved playing golf. She wasn't able to play golf. She couldn't stand and do the dishes. She couldn't sleep at night. And then after the vertebroplasty, she said it was like a miracle. The pain was gone, except, you know, she was in the sham surgery group. And overall, what several of these trials have shown is that there is no difference between the sham surgery and the real surgery, but both groups do significantly better. That trial can't say for sure how many of them would have felt better anyway. That's why you need these other studies to sort of look at the mechanisms. But the researchers were convinced that this wasn't just patients happen to feel better by chance. They really felt that there was something else going on here.
And in Bonnie's case, she even felt well when she learned that the surgery was fake. It didn't affect how she was feeling.
Absolutely. I mean, there are some other studies, for example, in Parkinson's, where people had benefits, but then when they found out it was placebo, those benefits receded. But in Bonnie's case, she was still fine. She had no problems with that.
And you met some patients who were receiving hypnosis for irritable bowel syndrome. Describe what one of these hypnosis sessions is like.
Yeah, so this... Perhaps when people think of hypnosis, they either think of those sort of embarrassing stage shows when people impersonate Elvis.
Right, or, eat an onion, you won't taste like an orange, that sort of thing.
Yeah. Exactly. Or else this kind of, you know, going back into past lives or, you know, early abuse or whatever. But this is nothing like that. This is very down to earth. It's called gut-focused hypnosis. So it's about helping patients to regain, so patients with irritable bowel syndrome to regain control over their gut, using a lot of visual imagery. So a common one is to imagine your gut as a river. So somebody with diarrhea might want to imagine a slow-moving canal, whereas somebody mm-hmm. with constipation might prefer a fast-moving river. And trials show that while hypnotized, the patients can actually influence the rate of gut contractions, which is not something that's supposed to be under conscious control. A course of this hypnosis also reduces the sensitivity of the gut to pain, because that's a common thing in irritable bowel syndrome, that patients have their guts very hypersensitive to pain. And in trials as well, the hypnosis has been shown to help 70 to 80% of patients for whom all other treatments have failed. So that is an example of a sort of psychological approach allowing patients to influence physiological function in a way that you wouldn't be able to otherwise, and which is actually helping them to recover from that condition.
Mm-hmm. What would need to change about our medical system for some of these mind-body approaches to gain some traction?
Quite a lot, I would say.
Long pause.
Yeah.
Too many things.
Well, yeah, a lot of things. So first, I mean, we talked about some of them already. So there's where is the money coming from for trials? You know, we really need to have trials that can look at these other components of care, not just purely at the drugs, but look at how that care is delivered and what difference that makes. And there are some trials going on into this already. So at Harvard, for example, there was a trial showing that patients with irritable bowel syndrome who have a warm empathic practitioner have much better relief from their symptoms than when the practitioner is cold and polite. Or another one in acid reflux disease showing that patients do dramatically better if the consultation with the physician is longer, sort of 44 minutes long compared to the standard 18 minutes. So if we had more research like that, mm-hmm. I think it would give more justification, if you like, for sort of taking those elements more seriously rather than what we do at the moment, which is, you know, cutting appointment times and cutting medical staff to try and be as efficient as possible. But also just in terms of scientists taking this stuff more seriously, and maybe rather than just dismissing it all as sort of woo and flaky claims. And obviously there's an awful lot of that out there. But that doesn't mean that the mind doesn't have any role to play. And I think some of these neuroscience studies, whether it's in placebo research or a lot of the mindfulness research that's showing, you know, changes in the physical structure of the brain, for example, I think that's helping people to take this more seriously.
I was about to say that. You know, I've been around a long time covering this as a journalist, and mindfulness now, of all the things, all these new age sort of mind control things, seems to me to be being taken more seriously than other things in the past. Did you find that also?
There's still a lot of resistance to it as well. But yeah, it's just been this incredible surge in popularity, both in people wanting to try mindfulness, but also in the scientific studies as well. I think there's often an element of fashion with these things. So hypnosis, for example, is completely unfashionable. You will not get any money to study that. And mindfulness has sort of taken its place, and that's on the up now. And there are very good trials now showing that training in mindfulness can reduce symptoms such as pain, fatigue, anxiety. It protects against relapse and depression. Where the trials aren't as good so far is then looking at, does that affect sort of physiology? So does reducing stress reduce inflammation, for example, and how does that affect the progression of autoimmune diseases and our susceptibility to infection? And there's some evidence that's sort of quite intriguing, suggesting that there might be an effect there, but we do need more research on that.
Talking with Joe Marchant, author of the book Cure, A Journey into the Science of Mind Over Body, on Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. Where do you think you know, one thing that used to be popular that you heard about a lot and it's sort of still being practiced is acupuncture. Did you come across cases of acupuncture there?
Yes, mainly demonstrating the usefulness of placebo responses, I think, because, I mean, acupuncture is, you know, you've got the physical needles. It's not really a psychological therapy, so I didn't look at it from that sense. But it's a very interesting case because in trials, generally, there is no difference between real acupuncture and sham acupuncture. So this is where you put the needles in the wrong places and they don't fully penetrate the skin. So that's telling us fairly clearly that all these sort of meridians and energy lines and the needles isn't really doing anything. But often both of those groups, again, improve significantly. So there's a very interesting trial done in over 1,000 patients with chronic back pain. And there were two groups. One group had real acupuncture, one had the fake acupuncture, and there was no difference between the two. But in this trial, there was a third group, and that third group received conventional care. So this was a combination of painkilling drugs, physiotherapy and exercise. And that conventional care group did barely half as well as both of the acupuncture groups, even the fake acupuncture group. So what that shows you is that just because something isn't any better than placebo, that doesn't mean it can't benefit patients. There are cases, particularly for conditions where drugs aren't particularly effective and where they have significant downsides, such as side effects and addiction, and where placebo responses are strong, and pain is a good example of this, where even something is working purely through these sort of placebo responses, these sort of social and psychological aspects of care, that can actually be better for patients than receiving the conventional drugs. Hmm. And I think that shows that we're doing something wrong in conventional medicine, if something with no active direct effect is better than conventional care.
In the book, we meet a guy named Carl Hines, and every time Carl takes his pills, he listens to the same song by Johnny Cash. What's going on there?
Okay, so this is research into conditioning. So I don't know if most listeners would know Pavlov's dogs.
I think they would.
I hope most people would.
Yeah, I don't have to go through that.
So Ivan Pavlov conditioned his dogs to, you know, every time he fed them, gave them their meat, he would flash a light or sound a buzzer, and they would salivate in response to the meat. But over time, they learned to associate the light or the buzzer with the meat until eventually they salivated automatically just in response to that psychological cue. They didn't need the meat anymore. So this is like a learned association. It happens, you know, a psychological cue triggers a physiological response automatically. And this happens in people as well. That's what happens when you salivate. When you think about biting into a lemon, you've bitten into a lemon before. Your body knows the appropriate physiological
response. So Johnny
response.
Cash would allow this reaction to happen without the drugs, just by hearing the music?
I'm getting to Johnny Cash. So this also works not just for salivation and digestion, but for a lot of physiological functions in the body, including the immune system.
Yeah.
So if you take a drug that suppresses the immune system a few times, your body learns that response. If you subsequently take a placebo, your body will automatically have that same immune response to that placebo, even though there's no drug there. And so these are trials that are trying to get people to learn the association. So Karl Heinz is a
I'm going to have you stop there because we have to take a break.
Sorry.
It's an interesting story. I want to give you full time to tell it. So we'll take a break and come back and talk lots more with Joe Marchant, author of Cure, A Journey into the Science of Mind Over Body. And my mind and body are telling me we have to go. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. In case you're just joining us, we're talking with Joy Marchant, a science journalist, author of the book Cure, A Journey into the Science of Mind Over Body. And when I rudely interrupted her, she was telling us a story about Karl Heinz. Every time he takes his pills, he listens to the same Johnny Cash song. And we got through the part about the bell and the light and the reaction. So what happened? What did he do?
Right. I'm so glad that you let me come back to this because it's one of my favorite
well, we
pieces
want to
of
hear
research
it.
In the whole book. So the idea is that you can learn an association with a psychological cue, and then that can have an effect on your immune system. So he's taking his immunosuppressant drug because he has a kidney transplant, so he needs to take this. And the idea is that alongside taking his drug, he listens to Johnny Cash, but also he drinks, it's this really bizarre drink the researchers have come up with. It's strawberry milk mixed with green food coloring and lavender oil. And I tried it. It's quite disgusting, actually. And it's just, it hits all your senses at once. It's a bizarre drink. So he takes this with the drug for a few times, learns that the association. And then the hope is that when he just has the drink, the placebo drink, and listens to the music and the rest of the sort of environment, when he does that on its own, that will suppress his immune system. And the idea is that hopefully will allow kidney transplant patients to reduce their drug doses, so their immune system is still suppressed but with a lower dose of drug. And that is important because these immunosuppressant drugs are extremely toxic, not least to the kidney, the very organ that you're trying to save. So it would be very important if you could do this with lower drug doses. And this has been shown to work in healthy volunteers. You can condition the suppressed immune response. There are also some small studies in autoimmune disease as well, showing that you can get the clinical response with a lower drug dose if you use this kind of conditioning technique. And now this is a trial that's happening in kidney transplant patients. And I just think that this has such, you know, fundamental implications if this can be shown to work, because reducing drug doses in autoimmune disease, allergies, transplant patients, potentially even cancer, there is some animal work in cancer showing that this can work. You know, that would have huge cost savings, not least, and as well as improving the quality of life for patients.
Let's see if I get a quick phone call in from McLean, Virginia, and Mark in McLean. Hi, Mark.
Hi, how are you?
Hi there. Speak up, please.
Okay, let me take you off Bluetooth. I think that will hopefully help.
I hope we're still there when we're off. Go ahead.
Let's see. How's this? Is this better?
Yes, go ahead.
So it's very apropos that Joe just mentioned cancer. I happen to be a cancer center director and a physician in a health system in suburban Maryland in Frederick. And we're doing a couple of things, and I don't think we're that terribly unique. One of our lead medical oncologists was a senior investigator at the NCI and spent a lot of his time researching complementary and alternative therapies. And we're using that for our cancer patients to improve their experience and to improve their spiritual and psychological well-being. And we're also working with an organization, a not-for-profit foundation called the Samueli Institute, that does evidence-based creation of healing environments for patients. So I do think that there's a lot of value in mind-body connection, for certainly for cancer patients and for folks in general. So I applaud the work that you're doing.
It's very interesting, Mark. Thanks for calling. It looks like some people are listening and reading, and maybe reading your book. Let's go to Fish Creek, Wisconsin. Gail, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. This is a great show. I had so much waiting for 25, 30 years for people to start talking about hypnosis and the real mind-body connection, to have that come in to be healing. I used to, when I was doing research with a chiropractor that I knew, we were actually pulling out the energy that was in the way. So we were working with the mind-body connection with energy, with helping with adjustments, and working with him, and we were finding that there was more clearing of the meninges out of the spine, and which was helping people overall, because that will affect the vagus nerve, which affects everything in the body and the immune system and the nervous system. And I'm wondering, I did some interesting work with my dentist, and to get to not have to do any Novocaine if I had a filling or anything done. Have they done any work with people with working, say, really with children or people with this kind of consciousness mm-hmm. work with dentistry?
Joe?
Well, there is one chapter where I look in the book not at dentistry, but at people undergoing invasive medical procedures, such as breast biopsies or destruction of tumors. So, you know, I think having a dental procedure would probably fall into a similar category. And just looking at the difference it makes when the medical staff change how they speak to patients, so stop using lots of negative language like this is going to sting or burn, try to speak to the patient in a way that makes them feel more in control, and also encourage patients to use visualization techniques to relax, a little bit like self-hypnosis, I suppose, to imagine yourself in a nice faraway place where you'd rather be. And that had actually quite dramatic effects in terms of the first of all, the pain and the anxiety that patients reported during these procedures. But then in turn, they required far less painkillers and sedatives. And whether it was because of that, I don't know. But the level of complications, the rate of complications during those procedures fell as well. So just through the patients being less anxious and not needing such high levels of painkillers and sedatives, you actually had better physical outcomes to those procedures.
Should doctors offer treatments like Reiki or acupuncture that don't perform better than placebo but do provide relief for patients? What's the right thing to do there?
Oh, now that is a controversial question. ultimately, I think the answer is that rather than kind of outsourcing this stuff to alternative therapies that often rely on explanatory frameworks that aren't scientific, I think we should be trying to understand, you know, these elements of care and ritual and how they help people and incorporate those into conventional medicine in an evidence-based way. The trouble is that's probably quite a long way off. So for a cancer patient now who's struggling with side effects of chemotherapy, for example, I would find it quite difficult to say to them, no, don't use alternative medicine if you feel that it helps you.
Right. Well, I want to thank you for taking time to be with us today. I'm just going to end with a tweet that came in from John Reese, who says, "Let mom kiss it and make it better is a good example of the placebo effect. I think mom's kiss really does make it feel better." There you go, from a very early age.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Joe Marchant, the science journalist, author of the book Cure, A Journey into the Science of Mind Over Body. We thank you for your hard work and bravery in writing this, Joe.
Thank you very much.
And you can read an excerpt from Cure at our website. Go to sciencefriday.com/cure. Our microbiome is a delicate balance. Diet, place, genetics, they can all affect our individualized bacterial communities. But just how far back does that microbial mix start to develop? A group of researchers say, well, it happens the second you're born. Babies born through C-section miss out on the bacteria usually picked up from the birth canal. The scientists swabbed these C-section babies with maternal microbes to see if they could restore their microbiomes, and the results were published in the journal Nature Medicine. My next guest is an author on those results. Maria Gloria Bello is an associate professor in the Human Microbiome Program at New York University. I should have called you Dominguez Bello. Thank you
very much. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for taking time to be with us today. Tell us about this. You conducted a small study. How is the microbial profile of a baby born through a C-section different from the one through a vaginal birth?
So if you expose a baby to vaginal fluids, the baby will pick up bacteria from the birth canal of the mothers. Mm-hmm. And these bacteria will flourish in different sites of the baby. And that happened both in vaginally delivered babies of our study, but also when we exposed the C-section-born babies to a gauze that was kept in the birth canal before the baby was taken out.
And how did you swab the baby? What was that like?
Well, we made a kind of a artisanal tampon with a sterile gauze. We folded the gauze as a fan and then in half and inserted it wet with a sterile solution. And then we took it out and waited. We put it in a sterile container, waited until the doctor took the baby out through the incision. And the first thing we did within the first 2 minutes after they cut the umbilicus was swab the baby, first mouth and then the face and rest of the body.
Mm-hmm. And how close could you get to the kind of bacteria that it would happen in a vaginal birth?
Well, we didn't restore completely, and we achieved partial restoration. And I don't know if we will ever restore completely, because labor in the shortest scenarios take 1 to 2 hours, and in the worst scenarios, 18. And those, after the mom breaks waters, the baby gets exposed. And labor takes at least a few hours. So, and our procedure is just seconds. So I think, and on the other hand, of course, we are not recapitulating labor. But we want to study, you know, by at least partially restoring the microbiome, can we also restore health? There are some diseases associated with being born by C-section or early antibiotics. Anything that impacts the microbes very early seem to have an increased risk in some of the diseases of the immune system.
Okay. Is it possible to follow these babies in your study to see how they develop?
Well, we are following them for 1 year. This paper was only for the first month, mm-hmm. and we are following them for a year, many more babies, 84 so far. But the study will still be microbiological. To do the clinical study and measure health,
yeah.
we need a randomized design, much bigger study of probably thousands of kids, and follow them for at least 3 years, and then measure obesity and, if possible, asthma, allergies. So it's a huge study, very expensive one. We are putting together a proposal, but we don't know whether we will get the money.
Mm-hmm. I'm Ira Flato. This is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. Talking with Maria Gloria Dominguez-Bayo about this really interesting work on C-section microbiome. You also, let's talk about the gut microbes, the fecal microbes of the C-section babies. Did they differ as much?
When a C-section baby is born and is not exposed to vaginal fluids, what they pick up is skin-like bacteria, human skin. We did a study swabbing the operating room, which normally is normally incredibly clean, you know, the floors, the handles. But there are some sites, like upper in the walls of the operating room, the ventilation grids, the top of the huge lamps that the surgeons have. If you swab there, there is some dust. We did studies of that dust, and we demonstrated there is skin flakes there, and those flakes have bacteria. So we think the built environment is seeding the newborn that is born by C-section.
So the baby is getting the microbiome of the room instead
yes,
of the mother.
Yes.
Oh, is that
the mother is probably the least source, because she's below. Gravity plays against her transmission. There are all the doctors, nurses are shedding, and also the air.
Yeah.
You know, the air contains the previous patient's skin flakes, the cleaner team. Who knows? It's a collective of human skin that is maintained in the operating room. So, I think mammals are born through a birth canal that is loaded with bacteria that are very relevant to milk, and then all mammals drink milk. This is adaptive. This is not by chance. So I think we still don't know what are the health consequences, but it sounds like adaptive. And we, you know, every time you cheat nature, there seems to be a collateral cost that we pay. And we are mammals. We cannot forget that.
Yeah.
So we should restore exposure.
You know, I'd heard years a while back that breastfeeding, one of the benefits of breastfeeding was not just that your mother's milk, which is very important, but that the suckling, the baby is getting the microbiome off the mom's skin as breastfeeds.
Absolutely. And you know what? The baby, the aureola of the mom that had a baby born vaginally, has vaginal bacteria. The baby, after the mom inoculates the baby or seeds the baby, the mouth of the baby comes to the aureola and seeds the aureola of the mother. And milk has components that are completely resistant to digestion by the baby, but they are, nature has them to select bacteria that lives in the intestine of the baby. So milk has indigestible components. It makes sense only in the view of feeding microbes of the baby, the good microbes that are ultimately from maternal origin.
Wow. Wow. This microbiome is so fascinating. It's something we love to talk about. And I want to thank you for taking time to talk with us today and bringing this news to us.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be there.
Dr. Maria Gloria Dominguez-Bayo is an associate professor in the Human Microbiome Program at New York University. Quick program note, next week our Sci-Fi Book Club convenes to talk about the Oliver Sacks On the Move book. But if you haven't picked up the book yet, there is still time to read and listen. We've got a Sacks-inspired playlist up on our website, stocked with Bach, Stravinsky, Mendelssohn. I feel like I'm back in my FM radio days. The perfect musical accompaniment for an On the Move. So listen at sciencefriday.com/playlist. B.J. Lederman composed our theme music, and our thanks to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. And if you're on our website this week, we've got a book that covers the beauty of math, from fractals and prime numbers to sine waves and Venn diagrams. And guess what? It's a coloring book. You know, this is the biggest fad now, coloring books for adults. Well, maybe you have them. I'm just catching up. Coloring books for adults are very in right now, in case you didn't know that. So grab your markers and check it out at sciencefriday.com/coloringbook. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flato in New York.